Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for what we call the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Good morning, Mr. Honlein.
Good morning, Nachum.
So 1 week after I highlighted the fact that too many listeners had pointed out that we are always talking about negative news, look at this. 7 days later, we get we are discussing one of the greatest pieces of news, and that is, of course, that the United States forces have taken out Osama bin Laden. So you see that, Malcolm? Sometimes we do lead with a positive news story.
We deliver.
We deliver is right. Take the listeners' comments seriously. A couple of things. I mean, this has been spoken about in the general media, obviously, to the nth degree, but there are a couple of the details which I think folks are very curious about regarding your opinion. Was this burial at sea necessary? Was it a good strategy now that we have a little bit of hindsight into this episode? What did you think? Did you think it was strange when you heard about the way that bin Laden's body was disposed of?
I was surprised, frankly, there wasn't more reaction in the Muslim communities about the way the body was disposed of, because it's not a traditional Islamic burial, even though he had the rites, as they said, administered to him before they dumped him in the sea. But the fact is that you don't want to create a shrine. You don't want to have a place that becomes then a place of pilgrimage where you know, in death he becomes bigger than in life. And I'm surprised, in fact, by the fact that not more has been made of it. But if you look at the polls about where he generally stood in public opinion, only amongst the Palestinians did he break 30% support, and that was 34%. But amongst Egyptians, it was 22, and Jordan, 13, and Lebanon, I think it was 1. So amongst Muslims generally, he wasn't such a revered figure, and he wasn't playing a critical role. He was more of an iconic figure now. So I think the reaction has been quite muted. Also, you know, he killed many more Muslims than non-Muslims in the attacks that Al-Qaeda has carried out and continues to carry out. But on the other hand, we shouldn't assume that this is an end to this. Al-Qaeda will continue. It has grown since after 9/11, when they had maybe a couple hundred people to more than 1,000 who graduated their Afghani training camps. And now they have these groups from China to North Africa.
Right.
Who are operatives.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. But just back to this whole burial issue, this back to the whole photograph, you know, releasing photos issue. Didn't it seem a bit bizarre that we're that concerned, or maybe with here in the United States we're used to this already, that we're so concerned or in a way, you know, dream up this scenario that certain pockets of people around this world are going to react in such a, you know, violent fashion if, in fact, these things aren't done the way the President of the United States decided to do them? Wasn't it a little overboard?
Well, there are a lot of people who feel that, you know, we shouldn't be so sensitive. They're not sensitive in a way that the burials that are afforded to people at the World Trade Center, et cetera.
Or anywhere else.
But I mean, America is different, and democracies work in different ways. Israel, the same thing. People have said, why don't they bury? I remember all the times.
Okay, but if I would have asked you on Monday if those photos would be released, wouldn't you have said yes?
No, I wasn't sure that they would be released.
Really?
When I heard the nature of the photos, and I think the decision was a right decision.
Wow.
Not to release them.
Interesting. So it's just mine and other people's curiosity that forces us to the other side of the issue.
Yeah, we all want to see the gruesome pictures.
Well, not just that. And no conspiracy stuff here, but I don't know. I think a lot of people would like to actually see him dead. You know what I mean?
Well, that's also a problem with the burial at sea, is that you don't have a body.
Right.
Nothing to show. And in the Middle East, where people are prone to these conspiracy theories anyway, that this will feed it. But I could see much more damage coming from the production of gruesome photos that, you know, become then posters and become a rallying point in certain places in the Muslim world, the Arab world. So I think, look, everything is debatable, but
right.
The burial at sea was more of a surprise to me.
You had many of us know you had a very close relationship, relatively speaking, with President Bush. Did he ever express this to you, or did you see it in meetings with him, how he desperately wanted to catch this guy?
Oh, yes. It was clear the frustration he had about it. I heard it from people who worked with him, and there were indications even sometimes in the discussions. He was very serious and very committed, and I think he deserves partial credit for having put in place the operations that were carried.
And it took a lot of guts for the current president of the United States to make this. I would not have wanted to have been in that position to make this decision about whether to send those men in or not.
Right, and you never know the ramifications of a decision you make. But I think that for one thing, they had him under surveillance for quite a while. They were certain, pretty certain, 90%, 98% certain of the target. And I think that it sends an important message. And, you know, clearly a lot of people went into hiding the next day or that day. And that's where they belong.
So back to your point now about Al-Qaeda in general. So how strong is this network? I know symbolically in terms of a warning to, you know, to the bad guys, this was a very important episode. I'm not minimizing it. But, you know, terror seems to be everywhere. And you talk about terror cells on every continent, including our own, you know, all over the place. So how influential was bin Laden in this whole, you know, business of terror?
He was influential. I said I would say lately as a more of an ideological icon for the movement. I don't think he was involved operationally and even giving perhaps orders. He communicated via runners and messengers. So he was important. He remained important.
So this doesn't significantly weaken the international terror network.
But that, you used the right word, and that's where most people get it wrong. It's a network. It's not one organization. And that really is the distinction and understanding the implications of this, that it's a hydra. You know, it's many-headed. It's not where there's one center and all the orders came out, and therefore if you remove the center, the whole system dries up. It could be that Al-Qaeda will be affected by it. But the network of terrorist organizations and you know, their impact is not going to be is dropped. And look at the organizations, you know, the Muslim Brotherhoods around who condemned his murder, as they called it, or assassination, or whatever term they used.
Now, it's even the casual observer, you know, has to be skeptical when Pakistan says they had no clue that that he was there. I don't know what's more embarrassing for Pakistan, to admit that they didn't know or to admit that they did know. But explain this relationship. I mean, you've done this a lot in the last couple of years between the United States and Pakistan. Is it too valuable a relationship for the U.S. to make too big of a deal about the fact that Pakistan likely knew he was there?
We have a very strange relationship with Pakistan. It is an important ally. And we have to remember that this is not a potential nuclear power. It's an existing nuclear power.
Right.
We saw much damage when Aigu Khan, their leading nuclear scientist, you know, shared the information with a lot of sources. And the you know, the Saudis, others, always pushed our relationship, and they maintained a close relationship. I think that the Pakistani nuclear program was a proxy for Saudi Arabia, which probably funded it a lot as well. But we always had this, you know, strange relationship. On the one hand, it was Pakistan versus India, so we always got caught in the middle of that conflict, which is still ongoing despite efforts to reconcile or to diminish the tensions. Also, it was the offset to China. And there were many, I don't want to go through all the intricacies of the relationship, but you're right, it is a strange relationship. I think now it will come under much more increased scrutiny. We give them $1 billion a year in aid, and the question will be, why are we doing it? And we have to remember that Al-Qaeda was born in Pakistan, not Afghanistan.
Right.
And the army in Pakistan, unlike the other places where it's usually the resource against terrorism and against these Islamist groups, was the fostering them. They were supportive of it. So it's a really different circumstance. And then you had Musharraf, you have had the corruption amongst the leadership. We know that they play these duplicitous games. We know that there is corruption. It's rife throughout the echelons of government.
Isn't it likely that the United States intelligence knows whether Pakistani authorities knew about bin Laden? Isn't it likely they know that the answer to that question?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it because I haven't seen the reports.
Well, I'm not saying they would ever let us know. I'm just saying that
if you're speculating and saying, is it likely that officials in Pakistan knew, if not the president and prime minister, the answer is yes.
Right. I mean, I'm saying differently, that the United States intelligence likely knows definitively whether they knew or not at this point. Right.
Again, I don't know what they know, but I would say that you're right in assuming that they know that people in Afghanistan, and part of the reason why they monitored them, you know, and people say when they read the papers, I think today and tomorrow it'll come out that they knew for a long time and they've been watching him, is because they were trying to trace where he was going, what camps did he visit, what did he go and see,
right.
You know, who were the contacts that these messages couriers were working with.
You could imagine everybody's been watching, you know, so many people talk about and listening to everyone talk about every, you know, piece of minutia when it comes to if I hear how we have to keep our guard up one more time. I don't know. So last night I'm watching something where members of the media, prominent members of the media, meaning, you know, representing prominent outlets, are essentially giving the following message. Okay, Bin Laden has now been caught and killed. Now let's bring the troops home. Isn't that a really incongruous equation?
Well, that's what Ahmadinejad said. Osama dead, get out of Afghanistan.
Right.
So it is not, that is not the right formula. That's not the reason we should be getting out. If we should get out, it should be part of a considered strategic plan based upon accomplishing certain goals and objectives in the region. But if I can say something, I think people should be on guard.
Right.
You don't want to hear it. That, not because there's any...
I'm not minimizing the threat. I'm just...
immediate threat, but we did send out a notice right away just saying to people, based on information, you know, that DHS and FBI provide our secure community network organization, just to that people have to be careful. And if you notice that the information, and they've got treasure troves of information through 100 thumb drives and...
Right.
Computers that they took out.
I just think in the old days it was so much easier when, you know, a report would come out and most of the details would remain silent. Here, you know, the woman was thrown in front of him, the woman was pushed in front of him, the woman was shot in the leg, in the chest, protected him, didn't protect him, who wasn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, I appreciate the fact that we're able to have access to all these details, but it does get a little crazy when you pay so much attention to this stuff.
But right? I think it's even crazier when you think that they were watching this whole operation.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
As it's going down.
That's unbelievable.
I mean, that really is, to me, mind-boggling.
Incredible. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. I want to talk about Ahmadinejad in a moment, but before I get to that step... you know, obviously, there's always, especially in our community, there's always a concern regarding what's happening with Israel and its neighbors. Is there a way to judge the influence a guy like Bin Laden had on those terror groups that more directly affect Israel on a regular basis? Or again, this, you know, the network is so large that he had very little to do with the usual suspects.
Well, we know that Al-Qaeda had contact with Hamas. Mashal had contact with leaders of Al-Qaeda, and you see in the process of the condemnation, if you notice, Netanyahu referred to Hamas as the Palestinian version of Al-Qaeda.
Right.
But there were contacts, there were direct links. We believe that Al-Qaeda has a presence today, for instance, in the Sinai. I heard this from Egyptian officials, and their concern about it. We know that Al-Qaeda was directly linked to Iran. We think that even people from his family and others found haven, and I think he did at one point, in Iran. And this goes back to the 90s when Al-Quds members worked with Hezbollah to train and equip Bin Laden's fighters. So the relationships are more intricate than sometimes they're presented, even though it is not one network, one organization, and, you know, that everybody is just one part of, and everybody has a branch of the same tree. I would say that it's a forest with a lot of interlocking branches.
Right, and more unrelated than we think, right? I mean, Hamas is not taking orders from a guy like Bin Laden, and they probably have, you know, contrary interests in a lot of instances, right? I mean, I would.
They do have, and remember, you have Sunni Shiite differences, you have other political differences, you have the linkages, you know, that.
To lump all the terror groups together is like trying to lump all the ethnic groups together in these countries. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work, exactly. It's not going to give you the effective approach.
Right.
If you don't understand the structure, the differences between the different groups, you know, who works with whom. And how we sometimes feed these groups by virtue of what we do.
So what would have happened if we had no evidence that Bin Laden was responsible for 9/11? What would have happened if he wouldn't have admitted it, you know, on recordings around the world?
And but he certainly admitted enough terrorist attacks that warrant his elimination. I think it's an absolutely illegal move. I think that there's no question about it.
Right, and some of them directly against the United States, should remember. Right.
But he carried out attacks against Americans. He carried out attacks against all people. But as I said before, mostly he killed more Muslims than and therefore I think you see the reaction the muted reaction in much of the Muslim world.
A coincidence or not that it seemed that Ahmadinejad was missing throughout the last couple of weeks. I read about an Ahmadinejad boycott. I know he's having some internal governmental problems. Has he disappeared for a few days?
He's back, unfortunately. And what happened was there was a dispute, which I mentioned last week on the air, and said that I think that it's more significant. At that point, we didn't know that he wouldn't show up at the Sunday meeting of the cabinet and that he would be away for 2 weeks in a huff, angry that the Minister of Intelligence, whom he dismissed, Khamenei, reinserted and told him that he was a member of the cabinet and publicly, therefore, dissed Ahmadinejad. But it's part of an ongoing tension, which we have referenced,
right,
between
sure.
Ahmadinejad and Khamenei.
Right.
But on the other hand, and members of the Majlis, the parliament, took advantage of this to start passing some resolutions and doing things against the... And at the same time, now they've arrested about 20 of his aides, charging them with sorcery and having invoked, you know, magical powers against the government, against Iran.
Yeah, it sounds like a witch trial, huh?
It's a potential witch trial.
Yeah. Now, I saw that this morning, but
we should notice,
yeah,
at the same time, the Iranian Navy has dispatched warships to the Mediterranean Sea. They said they're going to visit countries like Syria as before. They deployed additional ships to the Gulf of Aden. That we shouldn't think that because of what we read in about some of the dissension, the Iran Revolutionary Guard is in control, and they're continuing to do what they do.
But that's
this fight is being taking place at a much higher level.
Right, but that's the impression some people had, that his hiding signaled that he was starting to fear some of these protests and, you know, revolutionary tactics among the among the general public in Iran, but that none of that happened, right?
That wasn't, you know, when he's faced with that kind of confrontation, as you see, they have no hesitancy to act and to clamp down and to use brutal methods to subjugate the people. Well, this was an internal fight. I think that he claims now that they will work it out in the next few days.
Right.
And he made an announcement yesterday to that effect.
No, I'm sorry.
But I wanted to say also that, you know, they're having a lot of problems also internally. They announced yesterday, or there were reports, that they're negotiating with Iraq, Armenia, Afghanistan, other countries to try and export their oil. But what was interesting is that another minister, in a off-the-cuff remark, complained about the fact that they're being paid in Syrian currency, which is virtually worthless today, certainly down very much. Because they're exporting through Syria, they can't do it in other ways, and then they're accepting Syrian currency, and he's complaining about the fact that they're at that point, which shows how the sanctions really are working. They, of course, now say that Israeli jets are massing in Iraq, and they're preparing an attack, and they blamed, of course, everything that goes on in every other country, especially Syria, where they are heavily invested today, and that is another issue that
right.
has them depressed.
Did you confirm the falsity of the report about the Israeli jets in Iraq?
I would say that is not true.
And did you know that right away?
Of course. I mean, if Israeli jets are going to mass, they're not going to know about it. And and by the way, this week we also had legislation introduced, which is going to be very important. The Iran Human Rights and Democracy Promotion Act, and Senator Mark Kirk and Kristen Gillibrand were the two of the leaders, and Ted Deutch and Robert Dole in the House, which will deny Iran, the regime, the ability to oppress the people and to support the democratic activists, something we have long urged and advocated, and I think it's a very important...
What do you mean, a congressional resolution?
A congressional legislation,
wow.
which will support them and help them, and again, it's an important message because, you know, as long as the Iranians think they have free reign and nobody's going to be standing up for the people in Iran, then they'll continue to oppress them in the most brutal way.
Is Bibi coming to the White House on the 20th of May?
Bibi is coming. The president announced the invitation and the meeting. I think that is, because of what happened the visit before last, that they're showing that this is... a friendly invitation, open invitation. He's also scheduled to speak to a joint session of Congress during that visit.
Is Bibi playing the aftermath of the Hamas-Fatah deal the right way?
Yes, I think, first of all, I'm not sure that he has many options, but the Fatah-Hamas deal really reveals many things, and it's, you know, it's far more complicated, I think, than people who just look at this and say, oh, it's, you know, we see the PA collapsing to Hamas. We have to think about the potential implications down the road, and we mentioned before that Hamas's ties to Al-Qaeda with Mashal. number one, we shouldn't assume that this is a real deal. At the signing yesterday, there was a fight, and the debate was whether Mishal, who's the leader of Hamas based in Damascus, would be allowed to address the group, where he would be seated. Abbas didn't want to let him have a seat. So they ended up that none of the leaders signed the actual agreement. The underlings signed this agreement, and you already see the rifts that are taking place, and then you're going to have a fight over the release. The agreement calls for the release of all their prisoners. At the same time, yesterday, Hamas operatives were still being arrested by Fatah agents. So they're facing a real threat that Hamas in an election could take over like they won the last election. And I think it's why almost universally you see the condemnation and the criticism, with the exception of great scholars like Jimmy Carter, who still will never get it. But this essentially ends that the Obama administration, number one, will be required legally to end the aid, more than $600 million we give them. It also means about the training of the security forces. It means Fayyad is out, and that ends the institution-building phase. It'll give greater impetus to their move in September, towards the unilateral declaration, which is becoming, finally, people recognizing the seriousness of this. And the real nature of what this means in terms of Egypt's changes, the breakdown of law and order in Egypt, the fact that they want to open up the Gaza, which means the smuggling increases, but just more openly, that more and more people can come into Gaza freely. And we see the tie to the Muslim Brotherhood, which announced now that they're going to challenge 50% of the seats in the Egyptian election, not 35% of last week.
So I'm trying. Is this a correct assessment or not? From the PA point of view, the more direct path to a declaration of a unilateral Palestinian state would be is if they're aligned with Hamas. If the PA stays independent, it's going to look really suspicious internationally if they try to push for the unilateral declaration of Palestinian state.
The fact that they can make the argument now that people said you only represent half of the Palestinian people, now we have everybody inside the tent, it does enhance in their perception the drive. On the other hand, when many of the countries, Merkel yesterday issued a pretty strong statement warning against unilateral recognition.
Unlike the United Kingdom and France.
Pardon me?
Unlike the United Kingdom and France.
Unlike, well.
Who said they may
make reservations on the Hamas-Fatah deal. They did not. They did say they're still flirting with the.
They said they might recognize a Palestinian state.
Right, and that's so that's
Merkel was stronger than
Netanyahu,
that,
et cetera. But they have to be reminded that the Oslo II Accord, which the European countries signed, says that neither side can initiate or take any steps that change the status of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip pending the outcome of permanent status negotiations. They signed it, so how can they then recognize it when their signature endorsing this document? And by the way, the General Assembly already recommended the creation of state in 1988, and insisted on the 67 lines even at that point, and it was backed by 104 countries with only, I think at the time, U.S. and Israel opposing it. So the Europeans don't change their views very much, even though they like to play the games and they make, solicitous statements. But bottom line, they haven't been very good.
Is Russia signed on Oslo II also or not?
Is Russia signed on Oslo II? Were they part of the deal then?
Do they also have a commitment not to recognize a change in Gaza and the West Bank without direct negotiations?
Well, they, again, have been playing a very duplicitous game.
Right.
They do on everything else. So they flirt with the recognition argument, but they're not happy about the Fatah thing. And they also have to be concerned that if the UN establishes the principle that people can go to the General Assembly, then they have to worry that the people in Chechnya will do the same thing as well.
Didn't they have a really muted response to the killing of bin Laden?
Very muted, because, it was popular. It was something that got the accolades. They were very unhappy the United States gets credit for it. So they were very muted in their response to it, but they have to welcome it because, they have a huge problem with terrorism inside Russia as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it. There have been episodes, certainly.
But we should also note that the Egyptians now, if you see the statements of Abre Moussa, the leading candidate for president, who wants now to reassess even the peace agreements with Israel, and is playing that card because he knows that by a 54-36 margin, the Egyptian people said they want to abrogate the agreement. There's not great support for it, so he knows it's a politically sellable idea, and he's appealing on that basis. And they're talking about doubling the price of the gas, and others are talking about cutting off the sale of gas altogether and saying they're not obligated to continue those sales. We see the internal situation in Egypt economically. It's certainly terrible. They lose $1 billion a month on tourism alone, and their economy, they say, is in ruins. And it's one of the reasons why the army and everybody is so anxious to get out of that circumstance, because they know they can't sustain it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I just think that we should see the connection of what happens in Egypt to what happens in Gaza, and you know, they're the ones who took the initiative to bring Hamas and Fatah together. They're also reaching out to the Iranians. They're having exchanges with the Iranians. They've had visits with them. This is a very serious change in the region.
I'm sorry that my insatiable curiosity continues to interrupt you. I know we spoke about this last week, but hey, it's a week later. Things change a lot in the Middle East. Can Assad avoid being the next Mubarak or not, especially with all these demonstrations that are going on as we speak?
That's an interesting way to put it, because the question is Assad a Mubarak situation? Is Assad an Iranian situation, i.e. when they had the Abur, and I think it's more likely the latter. For one, you know, he has no choice. The Alawites know that they're going to be wiped out if there's a real collapse of the regime, and that would affect him, meaning his family,
right,
and the others. If you look at who the army is, as I pointed out, I think before, it's the fourth army that takes on the brutal assignments, which is run by his brother. Doesn't show that the whole army, and also the demonstrations are not so much in the major cities. It's not the middle class, not the upper class that is really engaged in it. And they have blamed everybody, the Palestinians, the Israelis, the U.S., the Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, for everything that occurred. You don't have a unifying force like a national army as you had in Egypt that could step in. This is all linked to Assad and to his control. You break that, you break him, you break the regime, and then you have a country that is really artificial, and you have the Kurds, the Druze, you have the Sunnis, you have the Alawites, you have six different entities that in which a country could break down. Also, he is now being assisted and aided by Iran, from everything from cameras that take pictures in the light switches, the traffic lights, to training, to arms, and other things that they are giving Hezbollah as well, training some of the combatants. And he has made a decision to go to crush the movement. Today will be very important because today is a day of defiance.
Right.
We'll see what happens in the next few hours. There were massive tanks surrounding Damascus that were then last night that dispatched to the region, to the different areas where you've had the most severe problems.
So you know what the difference is between him and Mubarak? He has a better support system.
Look, if Mubarak, and I ask this of leaders in Egypt and elsewhere, if Mubarak had clamped down the first day,
right,
he could have crushed this.
Right.
Now, Assad has two big problems on the horizon. One is that the International Committee of Jurists is bringing charges against him at the International Criminal Court, and they want another campaign to bar them from the UN Human Rights Council, which is a joke, you know, in and of itself. But
right,
more importantly, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has a new leader, you know, the former leader El-Baradei is one of the candidates for president, but as I said, I think he was apparently a stooge of Iran.
This is Amano, the new one?
El-Baradei.
The new one, I'm saying.
No.
Oh, El-Baradei is the new one?
El-Baradei. El-Baradei is the old guy. The new guy, who's a Japanese,
Amano,
who has been exposing all this stuff, now they've come to the conclusion that the place that Israel bombed in Syria was, in fact, producing nuclear weapons, and they're going to give a report which will go to the Security Council and could become the platform then for additional sanctions on Syria, which they could not get through on the murder of all these people, and the Chinese, the Russians, and others,
right,
as we indicated before, blocked it. But this could become a basis on which you could have more sanctions.
So, again, the world has to thank Israel. And if you think about it, the aftermath, the reaction of Israel's neighbors and enemies to that episode where Israel took it out 5 years ago, it was worth it. Say it again?
Absolute silence.
Exactly. It was worth it. So anybody who thinks about what the repercussions might be if Israel takes action against Iraq, against Iran, or anybody else, you know, I know, you know, we have to analyze, I guess, why the world reacted the way it did in 81 with Osirak. But maybe people are so afraid now that they're willing to let, you know, somebody go in and wipe out one of these nuclear reactors.
Well, what is the message of what America did to Osama bin Laden? Why is it okay, and it is okay, obviously, that they did a targeted hit against a leader and eliminated this threat, and rightfully so? But Israel was condemned when it took out people who were murdering its citizens, not thousands of miles away, but right there on its borders, when it took out the Sheikh Yassin and other leaders. You know, they right away get subjected to all the criticism, and they say how terrible targeted assassinations, which eliminate an individual or two individuals and do not affect the general populace. It's a lot more humane than broad-based attacks and bombing, and yet Israel was criticized. Now we'll see whether this precedent carries over. My bet is not, but it's an important message.
Oh, you win. Because there's not a chance that Israel won't be condemned for whatever their next move is, even if it's targeted, even if they make sure not to hurt anybody on the way. It's impossible.
One of the other things I wanted to mention on Syria was to see the important role that Al Jazeera is playing.
Oh, good point.
In mobilizing. And so people, when we talk about the role of the Internet, of Facebook, all these things in the other revolutions here, Al Jazeera clearly has targeted and joined the efforts to bring down the regime. And they're broadcasting the pictures of the killing of the protesters on the outside of outside of Damascus and Daraa and the other places that they were able to get the cameras through. They're obviously barred, but people are sending them, you know, these homemade films, and they are broadcasting and highlighting it. We're not likely to see an Islamic takeover. Egypt, as I said, the Islamic Brotherhood is much stronger. Remember, Assad's father crushed the movement. He killed them. So they maybe represent 15% in Syria. So, again, that was another difference in terms of the internal dynamics of the situation.
Right. All right, Malcolm, thanks so much. We'll speak again next week. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos.
Friday morning.